Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome back to Year in Review. And today, we're going to talk about localized urothelial bladder cancer, both non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive disease. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Ashish Kamat from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Professor Tom Powles from the Barts Cancer Institute, Queen Mary University of London, in London, United Kingdom. Today, we're here to talk about one of the most interesting areas in oncology, urothelial or bladder cancer in general, but also localized disease. And as I do with all of these programs I met individually, we are going to talk about the use of non-approved agents and regimens, so you can check out the package inserts for more. But I met with each of the faculty separately. We recorded interviews about 30 minutes in length. Tom discussed muscle-invasive disease and a bunch of papers presented in the past year in that regard. And Ashish talked about non-muscle-invasive disease. Again, these are great presentations. They're in the chat room if you want to check it out soon. Otherwise, we'll be mailing out links to that as well as to this webinar tonight. We're not going to go through all the papers. You've probably heard about most of these. We'll refer to them, and we'll show some slides, particularly the conclusion slides from these two talks. We're really going to try to talk about taking care of patients today and also where things might be heading in the next couple of years. So much has happened in urothelial bladder cancer. It's just amazing and incredible and so, you know, encouraging to see this. And we'll also check out, we ask the faculty what's coming up at AUA and ASCO in terms of new papers. But here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of an intro. I want to get the faculty's take on radical cystectomy before we start getting to all these papers and how they relate to patient care. And then we'll spend our time talking about muscle-invasive and non-muscle-invasive disease and really ask some basic, straightforward questions. But just to get started, Ashish, you know, of course, oncologists and urologists obviously deal with patients all the time who had radical cystectomy, but you all have had a lot of experience with that. I'm just kind of curious, I'm asking you as a medical oncologist, what do you say to your patients? I know you individualize it, and people get cystectomies for a lot of different reasons. They have a lot of different goals. But what are some of the key quality of life considerations? How do you find patients responding to it? Do you have people who have regrets about going through it? Obviously, we're going to talk about the hope that maybe we'll get to the point where we won't need to do as many cystectomies. But I'm just curious about your perspective on radical cystectomy. We're talking about localized disease, and that's a big part of that. Ashish, any thoughts?
So first off, Neil, thanks again for having me on this. Always enjoy doing it with you. The radical cystectomy question really is something that's at the crux of everything that we do when it comes to bladder cancer. Because in many ways, if it's non-muscle invasive disease, muscle invasive disease, that's sort of one of the endpoints that we have in mind and the patient has in mind. And the patient is constantly trying to fight that, right? They're trying to avoid the radical cystectomy. Having, you know, been doing this now for, gosh, almost 29 years, I have yet to meet a patient that walks into the office and is very happy at the thought of having a radical cystectomy. Some will get there. Some will actually request it after being, you know, on treatment for muscle invasive or non-muscle invasive bladder cancer because they're getting tired of the recurrences and everything that goes with it. But it is a life-altering procedure. So the first thing really that we have to keep in mind is how is it going to impact the quality of life of the patient? And I just want to say right out there at the outset, the radical cystectomy and the quality of life that patients have today, when I say today, over the last 10, 12 years, is very, very different from what used to be the case in the 90s or even early 2000s. There are patients with radical cystectomies that are playing professional golf. They're doing marathons, triathletes. You see them on TV. I can't mention names. I could mention one name because she's a very young kid and she was actually featured on CBS Sports playing soccer with a conduit in place. And so it's public knowledge. But the bottom line is radical cystectomy is a life-altering procedure. And when we're talking to patients, we have to keep that in the back of our mind that their life is going to be different. It's not going to be the end of their life or end of the quality of life, but life is different. It does have complications. And there's a good amount of morbidity associated with the first 90 days of the procedure. So just like a patient getting chemotherapy or ADC or any treatment, while they're on treatment, and in this case, I consider on treatment to be actually surgery, hospital stay, and the first 30 to 60 to 90 days after radical cystectomy, their life in many ways comes to a standstill, right? And then we can go into the nuances of the different diversions, conduit, neobladder, et cetera. But unless you want me to, I think we can leave that for another day.
So, Tom, I'm curious about your experiences as a medical oncologist seeing these patients. What are some of the quality of life issues that seem to be most bothersome to patients? And what are some of the perioperative complications that might need to be considered, you know, when treatment is being considered, for example, adjuvant therapy?
Well, Neil, all of us, as we sit here with our bladders, they're working as we speak. And that's quite important. One of the things which I say to my patients after feedback, as Ashish has said for many years, is you'll miss your bladder when it's gone. And while there are alternatives, they are inevitably, not always, less attractive than keeping the bladder in situ. I think there are two complicating issues which need to be assessed and discussed. Number one is there is a subgroup of patients who have local disease who are going to the loo every hour and their lives are becoming somewhat unmanageable because their bladder is no longer working in the way it was, you know, 10 or 15 years before. And that is an important consideration. So when Ashish says, you know, as a surgeon, I see patients and actually it's a relief when their bladders are gone, I've heard that feedback also. So it would be wrong of me to say every patient who has their bladder removed regrets it. There will be patients actually who symptomatically are slightly better. But on the whole, there is a complication associated with long-term quality of life, in my opinion, being less good than those patients who have a functioning, well-functioning normal bladder. So that's number one. Number two is, Ashish is absolutely right. We're going to talk about this in a second, but it is a real hurdle getting over this procedure. And not all patients, for example, we know from our perioperative trials that many patients who have surgery are never able to restart systemic therapy. And what that probably means is they're picking up comorbidities associated with the surgery. Many patients with urothelial cancer are in the eighth decade of their lives. Indeed, some are in the ninth decade of their lives. And so we're talking about a population with comorbidities, and many of them have got other problems. You know, many of them have smoked cigarettes in the past and got airways disease, etc., because bladder cancer is associated with that. So it's not necessarily the easiest procedure. It's not the easiest population. It is a big procedure. It's much bigger than, it is much bigger than a nephrectomy. It's much bigger than almost all breast surgery. I can't imagine any breast surgery being bigger than that. And while I accept having your pancreas removed is bigger, it's like having one of the biggest operations you can do towards the end of your life and then trying to get through that process. So I see it, and I've always described it, as being the absolute key to muscle-invasive bladder cancer, because without it, patients die very quickly. But I also say to patients, your life's unlikely to be the same afterwards.
So that's a great input. We could talk about this for a long time. I'm also curious, and we might get into this later, what are some of the support services, particularly that might be available at a tertiary center, but maybe are not as easily accessible, that benefit patients. But let's jump into some of the papers that we wanted to talk about. We're going to start out... we're going to start out talking about adjuvant therapy, and particularly IMvigor011 and CheckMate 274. But then we'll also talk about neoadjuvant therapy, including, of course, the dramatic data that's coming out now on EV Pembro. And then we will talk about bladder-sparing approaches. But Tom, in your talk, you went through your New England Journal paper and the presentation at the GU Symposium. You had one at the GU Symposium this year, and then at ESMO on the InVigor study. And then, of course, previous to that, the CheckMate 274 trial, which you presented in your talk, some ctDNA findings. But before we kind of get into, and you can kind of integrate, and we'll go through a few of the slides, but my question to you, Tom, is right now, how are you approaching adjuvant therapy in your own practice outside a clinical trial? When are you using it? What are you using? How do you incorporate other modalities, particularly ctDNA? Ideally, how would you like to be doing this, Tom, if you didn't have any reimbursement issues to deal with or regulatory issues to deal with? And how do you think things are going to change over the next few years in terms of adjuvant therapy, Tom?
Well, the first thing to say, Neil, is adjuvant therapy has been focused on immune therapy, particularly nivolumab, but there was also a positive DFS trial for pembrolizumab in unselected high-risk patients for some time. These are patients who have not had prior immune therapy. They've not had neoadjuvant immune therapy. And actually, this conversation is a little redundant because it's now the case that perioperative neoadjuvant therapy has superseded the adjuvant approach. So this adjuvant discussion is for those patients who have not yet had immune therapy, but Niagara with gemcitabinumab and the two EV-303 and 304 trials with perioperative EV pembro suggests we should be giving immune therapy, particularly EV pembro, prior to surgery. Now, there will, of course, be some patients who don't have that for whatever reason. But for those patients that have not had neoadjuvant immune therapy, there are two categories. Those patients have had chemotherapy alone. And I would put it to you today that if you're fit enough for platinum chemotherapy, you're probably fit enough for immune therapy as well. So I don't think there are going to be that many platinum chemotherapy patients in the future. But there will be patients who have cystectomy alone for whatever reason. And those patients, what we know is the following. We know if you've had an operation and you are ctDNA positive, and that's about half the patients, we know that if you intervene with atezolizumab versus placebo in that population, there is a survival advantage associated with that early intervention. It is also true that for those patients who are negative and are tracked for a year and become positive, those patients are also in the same trial, randomized to atezolizumab or placebo. And the same applies. The early intervention without radiology disease based off ctDNA alone, there is a survival advantage associated with atezolizumab versus placebo. We also know that if you are ctDNA positive post-surgery, you've got about a 95% chance of relapse. So almost all those patients relapse. So if you're positive, yes, you need treatment. But it's also true about half the patients are negative and they remain negative for that track period. And those patients have an excellent outcome. Only about 3% of those patients are dead at 2 years. Most of those deaths aren't urothelial cancer. There's about a 5% relapse rate. It's important to remember that in all of the trials, nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and atezolizumab, none of those achieved overall survival. So in InVigor 11, where we then find a population and we achieve overall survival, it's inherently obvious that in those patients left behind, they can't also have an overall survival. Otherwise, all the trials would have been wildly positive. On top of that, their risk of death from bladder cancer is vanishingly small. And therefore, we can conclude that we can spare those half patients who are negative intervention. Heaven forbid, if they were to relapse, we can give them EV pembro at relapse. And we can focus on those positive patients, giving them early intervention with immune therapy associated with a survival signal. The InVigor 11 trial showed us that, but actually retrospective data from other data sets, including the pivotal nivolumab trial, shows exactly the same thing. The benefit is confined to the positive patients. So defining clear practice changing, but not necessarily as clinically meaningful as it would have been 5 years ago because of the neoadjuvant immune therapy trials. And InVigor 11 does not tell us when we can stop neoadjuvant immune therapy. It tells us when we can start adjuvant immune therapy. And that's an important distinction.
What about the type of treatment? Any preference in terms of IO? Do you prefer atezolizumab since that was what was studied in the InVigor study? Tom?
So, Neil, I think you've asked a really good question, and I'm going to answer it, but it's going to be a little bit more nuanced, if I may. Number one, my preference is to stay on the trial. That's my preference. But if your hospital can only give nivolumab or pembrolizumab for whatever reason, I would be happy for you to translate these results into that setting, because we've actually seen from the retrospective data from 274 exactly the same finding. That's the first thing. So I'm happy with atezolizumab. That's what we did the trial with. But if you want to use nivolumab, I'm totally relaxed about it. There are more similarities than differences between these drugs. They've all had positive trials. They've all had negative trials. And there isn't a best drug amongst them, in my opinion. There is a more complicated question. Is if 95% of these patients are going to relapse, and it's inevitable, and EV Pembro outperforms single-agent immune therapy in the metastatic setting, but also in the perioperative setting, are we actually identifying the patients at the right time, but are we actually under-treating them? And if we treated these patients with EV Pembro, instead of improving overall survival, the hazard ratio of 0.59, would we go down to 0.30 and be even better? Now, we don't know the answer to that question, but there is an inherent concern of mine, is we haven't yet tested EV Pembro post-single-agent immune therapy. We don't know EV Pembro is as good post-atezolizumab. And so if you were a young, fit individual, and I realize there's no data to support this, you might say, okay, I know this cancer is going to come back. I know it's potentially lethal. Why don't we just double down and give the best treatment right now? Why give something that's not quite as good? Or alternatively, why not just wait for the cancer to come back and give the best drugs then, in the knowledge that I'm going to have stronger treatment? So I kind of see that. And there is the last bit to this, is that ctDNA is not as straightforward as positive and negative. Like PSA, you could be positive for a PSA test, but it could be 3,500. And that's very different from being positive with a test, a result of 10. The same applies with ctDNA. When the MTM goes above about 3, you've got very high disease burden. That's inevitably going to be associated with a short relapse. So it may be those patients with lower marginal levels who are likely to relapse, give those atezolizumab, and those patients with much, much higher levels that don't yet have radiological disease go in much stronger with EV Pembro.
So, Ashish, I'm curious about your thoughts about this as a surgeon. You know, we were just found out today we had an abstract we submitted to the ESMO GI meeting looking at ctDNA use in colon cancer, and there, you know, surgeons are getting used to that strategy, treating people that they might not have treated, under-treating people with adjuvant therapy. Also, Ashish, the issue of what type of assay. We see more and more use of so-called tumor-informed assays, Signatera, which is what was used in the InVigor study, which is actually, you know, a reflection of the patient's actual tumor as opposed to other assays that look for common mutations. Any thoughts, Ashish?
Absolutely. And I think Tom did a really phenomenal job summarizing a lot of work and a lot of data. As far as the tumor-informed ctDNA assay, for bladder cancer, I just want to emphasize and for the listening audience that it's only the tumor-informed ctDNA that has actually been studied and validated and used with any reliability. And I state this because, you know, through the International Bladder Cancer Group, and of course, you know, I do a lot of work back home in India where I grew up, there's probably at least 30 different companies touting that they can do ctDNA assays. And these are not tumor-informed. These are not validated assays. And if anyone listening is trying to use this in their clinical practice, I would urge them to go to use the validated assay, right? So just putting that out there. One of the things that Tom brought up, and it may have just slipped by a little bit, so I just want to emphasize, is that I do see in real clinical practice already people reading the study and looking at Invigor 11, and then Tom listening to your podcast and saying, aha, I heard Dr. Powell say that if you're ctDNA negative, you have an extremely good survival, which is true. But then they are translating that into the whole EV Pembro paradigm and telling their patients after radical cystectomy, oh, you don't have to go back to the medical oncologist. You don't need the adjuvant part of it. I just want to caution people to say that we haven't studied that. We don't know that. Is it likely true? Maybe. But at the current time, I think we have to stick to the plan, and the plan is perioperative combination therapy with the cystectomy as one part of it. Just because the patient's had a cystectomy, it doesn't mean you can throw the adjuvant part out of the equation, so long as patients are not having side effects. I mean, there's many things that go into it. But I think people are misreading the Invigor 11 study applying it in situations that are not quite as relevant right now, today, when we're discussing perioperative therapy.
And Neil, can I build on that? So,
sure.
So just to, because it is important, and Ashish is absolutely right. I suspect systemic therapy, well, we know from the neoadjuvant EV Pembro data that systemic therapy is curing lots of patients. And as that occurs, the likelihood is the best way of cure is to give, in my opinion, a year of immune therapy, for example. The best way of cure is to follow the protocol and give the same amount of drug as we did before. And if you clear your ctDNA with systemic therapy, that means it's working. But if you only give a suboptimal period, 2 or 3 cycles, and then you stop, that's probably not enough. And so it is actually quite hazardous not following what Ashish has said, to say, okay, you've had 3 cycles, you clear your ctDNA, you're fine, you're good to go. That's not true. We might show in the future that's true, but currently, bladder cancer, advanced bladder cancer, is a lethal disease. And telling patients they're okay after a short period of treatment is probably really poor advice as it currently stands without more information.
I think another thing that's easy to miss, because I missed it when I first heard about this and read the paper, is the fact that if you were ctDNA negative, you needed to be followed with more cDNA assays because you might turn positive, at which point you would need treatment. So it's not like you get a negative and then come back in, you know, a year or whatever. But let's move on. As you mentioned, Tom, it, you know, it seems that we're going to be moving more and more towards neoadjuvant therapy with these more recent studies looking at neoadjuvant EV Pembro. And also, you in your talk, you went through the Niagara study, perioperative durvalumab with chemotherapy as well, where we also have data with ctDNA that. But can you just talk a little bit about, again, the way you think about using neoadjuvant therapy, who you think should receive it, which neoadjuvant therapy should be received, what do you do post-op in terms of adjuvant therapy after that, and where ctDNA fits in general in these neoadjuvant settings, and also maybe a few words about something I just heard about fairly recently, which is urinary ctDNA. So, Tom, what about neoadjuvant therapy?
So let me start by just addressing the ctDNA setting, because we just talked about that. In this setting, ctDNA is purely prognostic. It gives you no information about when to start or stop therapy, and it gives you no information about when to select therapy. It does tell you the risk of relapse, and as time goes by, if patients remain positive, the risk of relapse increases. So I can park that issue. Just to add to that, with urinary tumor DNA, so that's UTDNA, you can use an informed approach in the urine, and you can also then sequence the tumor. And in the majority of patients, you can also find UTDNA. We haven't yet finalized the utility of UTDNA, and there's more work to do there, but it is very promising. Because with UTDNA and ctDNA together, we may be able to distinguish between what's local disease and what's advanced disease. But that's exciting for the future. In terms of the thinking of the current status of neoadjuvant therapy, if I give you a very brief history lesson, if I may, neoadjuvant chemotherapy with cisplatin was associated with about a 5 to 13% survival advantage, relatively modest, making 3 or 4 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy the standard of care. There was a debate about whether there was a best regime, but one regime was never shown to have a survival advantage compared to another regime when the same number of cycles are given, or indeed it was given only in the neoadjuvant setting. Gem-Cis, 3 or 4 cycles, became the standard of care. A big randomized phase 3 study, 1,000-patient trial called Niagara, added a year of perioperative durvalumab to that, so 4 cycles of durvalumab before with platinum chemotherapy surgery, followed by the remaining 8 cycles afterwards. That trial showed, compared to the chemotherapy and surgery alone arm, a 10% bounce in increase in path CR rate, a PFS, an EFS hazard ratio of 0.68, significant reduction, higher proportion of patients getting surgery in the combination arm with durvalumab, showing the surgical safety, and of course, for the first time, a significant overall survival advantage with a 25% reduction in the risk of death without any devastating safety signals associated with it. That resulted that becoming a standard of care. It even got approved in the UK by NICE, would you believe? That's how high the bar is for there. So that's it's a cost-effective, it's a treatment associated with survival. And that is or was the standard of care until ESMO last year. And since ESMO last year, 2 pivotal trials have come out. Those trials have looked at perioperative EV Pembro. So essentially, it's 3 or 4 cycles before the surgery, and then a total of 9 cycles of EV Pembro in all. So it's 9 cycles of EV Pembro and surgery somewhere in the middle. 2 trials, one compared with cystectomy alone, that was EV-303, and the second trial compared with platinum chemotherapy, just like the Niagara design. Both trials were conclusive, and both trials were eye-catching. They were eye-catching because the path CR rate, instead of 37%, was more like 60%. It was 55% and 56% in the 2 trials. That means for most patients, when they had their bladder removed with neoadjuvant EV Pembro, there were no cancer cells left behind. That has broader implications for bladder-sparing approaches in the future. But it's also true that both of these trials hit significant event-free survival, and those were 0.4s and 0.5s, and both hit overall survival 0.5 and 0.65 in EV-303 and EV-304 respectively. The safety signal was more complicated because 9 cycles of EV Pembro is probably, you know, cycle per cycle, EV Pembro is easier than platinum chemotherapy. But that period of adjuvant treatment, in one of the trials, only 25% of patients completed that adjuvant period. So there are some challenges there. We need to look more at that in the future. But it is fair to say that EV Pembro now in metastatic disease with EV-302 and now with EV-303 and EV-304 has superseded other approaches, including chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and other bits and pieces. And I often use the phrase, which actually comes from Michael van der Heijden, who, looking at it, he was the second author on this paper in front of us. You know, Michael crowned the phrase EV Pembro first, ask questions later. Because I think lots of patients who are coming in with different components of N1 disease or M1 disease or T2 disease, a lot of those patients with a spectrum disease, we're going to start EV Pembro and then make a decision about where we go from there after 3 or 4 cycles.
So just a couple of quick questions, and I'd like Ashish's view on this and also how he thinks the urologists are going to respond. It kind of sounds like everybody is going to, with muscle invasive diseases, maybe should be considered for or receive neoadjuvant therapy with EV Pembro, whether they're platinum eligible, older, et cetera. Is that what you're saying? And also, any role for ctDNA in terms of path CR, ctDNA negative, maybe offering the option of not using adjuvant therapy, Tom?
I would not be using ctDNA in this space currently beyond I'm interested in the level, and if you remain positive, it probably means your treatment's not working that well. And there's an odd paradox here, because in ctDNA positive adjuvant space that we talked about at the beginning of the show, we encourage there to give the positive patients a atezolizumab. Here, if you remain positive on pembrolizumab, that probably means it's not actually working. So in the adjuvant space, you start immune therapy, but you could always turn around the other way and say, you know, if you're in the neoadjuvant space, if you remain positive, you probably should be thinking about doing trial switching therapy. So I really wouldn't be using ctDNA in this perioperative space.
So, Ashish, I'm curious. Again, it sounds like, I mean, there's always been this debate about neoadjuvant therapy. For a long time, people said, well, everybody should get it who's platinum eligible. But certainly not everybody is platinum eligible. Do you think that surgeons or urologists are going to be open to the idea that it's going to be standard to go for neoadjuvant therapy?
So, Neil, the reason that debate has existed is mainly because of platinum eligibility and also a sense on many urologists' part that if the patient is sick, and here we're talking mainly those with borderline performance status or platinum ineligibility, and we give them something toxic, like, for example, IAG or something else, then they won't make it to the surgery, right? And then that's why there was this debate, should we do neoadjuvant therapy or should we just take the patient to surgery first and then get it out and then afterwards do adjuvant therapy, whether it's platinum-based or carbo or whatever. I mean, there have been many studies, many of them small number, you really can't hang your hat on it, including meta-analysis. I think today, in many ways, the advent of GC and Durva, and again, that did include patients that were borderline platinum eligible, even though it was a platinum eligible study. And of course, looking at the EV paradigm. And I just bring those two up because access is sometimes an issue. And in some countries, people may not have access to EV Pembro. But let's assume we're in Disneyland, we're here in the US, everybody gets EV Pembro. In many ways, surgeons are sighing with relief, because you don't have to think about these things. You know, if someone is really so sick that they can't get EV Pembro at all, there's a lot more going on with that patient, right? So in many ways, it makes the thought process easier for my colleagues in the community that may not live and breathe bladder cancer all the time. Patient has muscle invasive disease. And I hope this is actually going to be the norm. It's an automatic referral to the medical oncologist. Please go see my medical oncology colleague. Talk about EV Pembro. Talk about perioperative therapy, and then we'll work together as a team and plan your surgery in that paradigm. One thing I do want to bring up for folks that might be listening, I've heard this from different people, that surgery after EV Pembro can be extremely challenging and difficult. I don't think it's the surgery that's difficult. I think what's happened is that we have treated patients with bulky disease with EV Pembro and gotten a much more dramatic response than you would with cisplatin-based alone. And now these patients who are surgical non-candidates, unresectable, become resectable, right? And then you're going in and you're cutting through tissue planes that are essentially fibrotic remnants of tumor. And that's what's causing the surgery to be hard. It's not the reaction from EV. It's not the reaction from Pembro.
So, Tom, maybe a couple words. Again, in your talk, you went through the study looking at ipi-nevo followed by chemotherapy as an attempt to splatter the bladder. Also, the retain trials looking at ctDNA to guide response bladder preservation. I think there's a hope, and there are a lot of trials going on looking at neoadjuvant EV Pembro and maybe being able to avoid cystectomy in select patients. Any comments on where we are and where we're heading in terms of bladder-sparing approaches, Tom?
Yeah, so I'd like to give a shout out to both of these trials, both investigator-initiated studies, one from Europe at the top. This is the NKI study, which is ipi-nevo prior to chemo-rad. And the second trial from the US, from the Fox Chase folks, both amazing investigator-initiated work, both ahead of their time, in my opinion. The CTLA-4 PD-1 story, the ipi-nevo story, Nabucco was the surgical trial. This is the study which looked at radiation therapy and described radiation therapy post neoadjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition in great detail. The bottom line is it should make no difference, and it doesn't make any difference really about whether you're doing surgery or radiation in this population. We haven't done head-to-head trials against the two. At the moment, surgery remains the standard of care. Some people say historically we've tended to treat patients with radiation therapy who have a poorer performance status, and therefore that's why the surgery studies may be better. Other people say they've got brilliant cohorts retrospectively showing radiation therapy or TMT therapy is as effective. We don't know that. But what I like about that study is the same group has done a surgical trial with the Ipi-Nivo, and now they've done a second trial. There's going to be some data at ASCO looking at the same approach with Duvalimab, for what it's worth. That's, of course, in the public domain. The abstracts are out. Nick James's group is presenting that study. And it's going to build the information, particularly if we move into a bladder-sparing area. The second trial, the RETAIN trial, looked at platinum chemotherapy with an immune checkpoint inhibitor with Nivolumab. But instead of doing the instead of going on and having the surgery, some patients were allowed to spare that surgery. And essentially, under those circumstances, you have a group of patients that have had a deep response, a clinical complete response, and those patients are on surveillance and they're not having radical cystectomy. And the question is, what happened to them? Now, in both of these trials, they also looked at ctDNA analysis. The radiotherapy trial showed us that actually it was similar in many respects to some of the surgical trials that we've seen from a from a ctDNA perspective. But the RETAIN trial did tell us something new. And what that told us is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer does not reliably produce ctDNA. And what that means is if you want to track your patients with ctDNA after a bladder sparing approach, that may be effective for large muscle invasive disease, and it may be effective for M1 metastatic disease. But if you think that can prevent you doing cystoscopies, I'm afraid you're wrong. You're going to need to keep looking in the bladder under those circumstances. Is there a chance that UTDNA or other approaches could improve that in the future? Yeah, of course there's a chance. But I think at the same time, it's important to recognize the limitations of where we currently are, because as you said, Neil, there are many bladder sparing trials. Indeed, there are bladder sparing trials looking at EV Pembro in this space. And there's a study in New York that Matt Gowski is involved with. And there's a study called EV209 and announced today a study called EV309, which is a phase 2 and a phase 3 study in this muscle invasive bladder space. Those patients that have not had those patients who have achieved a complete response, just having surveillance and not having active intervention with radiation therapy or surgery.
So, Ashish, I always love talking with you about non-muscle invasive disease. It's just unbelievable how complicated. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a medical oncologist, but I think even urologists have a hard time keeping up to date with that. So, again, in your talk, you went through some really interesting papers. Obviously, we have several studies looking at adding immunotherapy to upfront treatment. We have the TAR-200 device, the pretzel, so to speak. You also talked about a study looking at erdafitinib in non-muscle. This is systemically, although we know it's also can be done locally with the TAR device. And then immunotherapy with nogapentagetim. And then also the issue Tom just was referring to, which is ctDNA in non-muscle invasive disease. Again, in your talk, you go through all the details, but I just want to kind of take a step back and say, first of all, how do you think through right now, outside a clinical trial setting, a patient who requires a treatment, how do you determine whether or not they need treatment, what treatment it is, and of course, what your thoughts are about adding IO to BCG, and any other data sets that you consider when you see patients today, Ashish?
Thanks for that question, Neil. It's a very complex issue, right? Because first off, we're trying to escalate therapy in the right patient and then de-escalate therapy in the appropriate patient as well. And I'll focus my discussion mainly here on the high-risk patients because that's what we talked about and those are the studies. But the largest population of patients that we see with bladder cancer is the non-muscle invasive cohort. That's about 75-80% of patients. We talk a lot about muscle invasive disease. That's about 20% of patients. And metastatic, thankfully, is a small percentage, right? But the largest cohort that we see is the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients. And off that, a good number of patients fall in what we call the high-risk category. And what do we mean by risk? I think that's the first thing I just want to explain to the people listening. We're talking about grade, we're talking about stage, we're talking about non-muscle invasive disease, but the risk for the patient is the risk of losing their life to something that starts out as a small little thing in the bladder, right? So that's the risk of progressing to muscle base of metastatic disease. I think once you keep that in mind, everything else falls into place. So if a patient has low-grade, low-risk disease, oftentimes I'll tell the patient, you can even go on active surveillance. I could see you back in 3 or 6 months. We can monitor this tumor. I don't have to go in. I don't have to resect it. You don't have to have anesthesia. We can just watch it. And it's a similar paradigm as with kidney cancer, small renal masses, prostate cancer, active surveillance. On the other hand, if a patient has high-grade disease, it's T1, it may be 3 millimeters, 2 millimeters, 1 centimeter in size, that can invade, metastasize, and kill the patient. And that's where we're always looking to improve the results of what we've had for many, many years. You know, we talk a lot about BCG. People sometimes forget that BCG has been around since the early 1900s. Calmette and Guerin, you know, developed it as a vaccine against tuberculosis. In the early 20s, 1920s, it was discovered or seen that patients that had had TB or the vaccine had lower incidence of cancers in general. And as you and other medical oncologists listening might remember, I mean, this was used against melanoma, against lung cancer, but it's found its home in bladder cancer. And in bladder cancer, it really has been the bar against which everything else has really had to be measured. And I'm glad that these trials have been performed. I'm glad that these trials have been reported out. And essentially, it was using BCG plus something. And in this case, we had two trials that read out positive. That's BCG plus cisplatin. That's the CREST study. And of course, the BCG plus DURVA, which was the POTOMAC study. And then the Atezo plus BCG, which was the ALBAN, was a negative trial. And if you want, we can go into all the reasons that those trials were negative. But then again, these trials should have reported out about 2 or 3 years ago. Every year, there was this promise of, oh, we're going to see the data. And we never saw the data. And that's because these studies were really benchmarked against BCG used suboptimally. And I've heard Tom say this, and I've heard many people say this. These trials, in many ways, educated people on the phenomenal results our patients can get if BCG is used appropriately. So again, just diving into CREST and POTOMAC, because those are the two ones that everyone talks about. Kudos to everybody, investigators, patients, 1,000-plus patient trials. And it did show that adding an IO to BCG does provide a benefit. This benefit was for recurrences, not necessarily progression. The progression numbers were too small to make any sort of conclusion. So hazard ratio 0.68 in both these studies for EFS, and that's event-free survival, right? Recurrences. Those recurrences may be small, they may be not meaningful to the patient, but still they were counted as events. And it was at the cost of toxicity. So a relative benefit of about 5-7%, depending on which study you look at, and a fivefold increase in toxicity of about 20-30%. So I think my read on this is that if I have a patient sitting in front of me that says, hey, what do you have that you can give me that can improve the results of BCG, I will discuss these studies. I will say that, yes, adding an IO agent, and these are not approved yet in this setting, but we assume at least POTOMAC will go forward for approval. The CREST folks have stopped the FDA process so far, but let's assume it's available. I will tell the patient that, yes, I do have the ability to add an IO to BCG at this point, but it comes with a certain amount of toxicity, and we do have trials currently ongoing, for example, KEYNOTE-866, that addresses the more practical question, can I start with BCG? And if the patient has an early non-response, not progression, but early non-response, can I then come in with an IO agent, right? I think that's a more practical clinical question. So today, I don't really see this changing what I do in the clinic. I will, of course, discuss it with patients, but for the most part, it's not going to change the administration of intravesical immunotherapy. What has happened, however, is people have realized that they can't leave out maintenance with BCG. You have to do induction. You have to do maintenance therapy. You have to do it right. And in many ways, that was the fault of us, the urology community. Because we've had BCG around for 40 years, people had started using BCG in a haphazard manner. You know, what do I like to do? What do I believe? Let me just do two doses instead of three doses. That's something that you guys would do in medical oncology, right? You stick with the protocol. You adjust it for toxicity and side effects. You just make up your protocol. So I think this is going to force my colleagues in urology across the board to stick to the BCG protocol that actually works.
So, Tom, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this and also this idea that Ashish just brought up of maybe starting out with BCG and identifying people who aren't responding well and how you would do that. Was it just a cystoscopy or any other, you know, UTDNA, et cetera? But also, Tom, why there was such a high toxicity in these trials? I think it was like 20, 25% grade 3. Of course, that's from BCG and the IO, but still, it seems like a lot of toxicity. So any thoughts about those two questions, Tom?
Yeah, so, I mean, I agree with what Ashish has said. I think that that BCG induction and maintenance is a high bar. I think one of the reasons these trials read out so slowly was because there were so few events compared to what we were expecting in the control arm, because historically we've been less good at TURBT, and I think we've been less good at giving maintenance BCG. The third arm of that was striking. If you didn't give the maintenance BCG, things went wrong quickly. So, you know, BCG is a fabulous. I don't know whose idea it was to give it in the bladder first, Ashish. I don't know the story there, why someone would want to give it in the bladder. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But whoever did it, it was a stroke of genius, as Tony Chueri would say. UTDNA and ctDNA do not have a role here currently, Neil. I wouldn't be using either. The ctDNA, true ctDNA positivity rate is probably 8%, 5 to 8%, I would imagine. And let me talk to you about toxicity for a second, if I may, because the melanoma doctors did this first, and then the kidney doctors, and then the bladder and lung doctors, and then everybody. But immune checkpoint inhibition for about 70% of patients is a walk in the park, very few side effects. 30% of patients are getting significant side effects, many of whom will require steroids to reverse that. And then probably about 15% of patients are getting life-changing side effects. And that ranges from arthritis to endocrine diseases to long-term respiratory or cardiac problems. That last, the cardiac, respiratory, they're all less than 1%. But when you add them up, they come to 3 or 4%. Now, CTC criteria are not good at collecting those. They're not designed to collect those. CTC criteria were designed to collect chemotherapy-type side effects. We are not optimally assessing adverse events for immune checkpoint inhibition. If you said to me, what's easier to give, platinum chemotherapy or single-agent immune checkpoint inhibition? Every day of the week, it's immune checkpoint inhibition. But if you said to me, what about abiraterone and prostate cancer or immune checkpoint inhibition? Then you're saying actually abiraterone is easier than immune checkpoint inhibition because you don't have that 15% chance of serious side effects. And when you go into a cancer where the chances of cancer-related death is in the first 5 years is 5 or 10% at most, and you've got a 15% chance of life-changing toxicity in the first 4 months, and your median age of that population, you know, their life expectancy is 10 years, you're beginning to get into an area of grayness about risk and benefit. And so I am not surprised that there has been some caution from the community, particularly the urology and oncology community, And I'm also under the impression that not all of these drugs are being taken forward by the FDA in this space. And I can see why there would be caution here. I think what we've shown is strong biology. Earlier therapy with immune therapy is really active because so few patients are at risk. The actual data is great. But we're taking large groups of patients with us who are not in harm's way. And we need to develop better biomarkers if we want to give more challenging drugs like immune checkpoint inhibition in this space.
All right, well, let's finish out with a few other issues that come up in terms of new research, non-muscle invasive disease. First, Ashish, TAR-200, the so-called pretzel, being used to deliver chemotherapy. Also, as I mentioned, also targeted therapy in terms of erdafitinib. Where are we with that today, Ashish?
Yeah. Just before I answer that, let me just address Tom's question. So it was actually my former mentor, Don Lamb, who thought about putting BCG in the bladder. He's still very active, comes to all the IBCG meetings, and you know we in the community owe him, and Alvaro Morales from Canada, who simultaneously the two of them thought about it and did small patient studies, and the thought process was, you know, it was being used for lung and melanoma, but was being given IV, and patients died, of course, because they developed, you know, BCGosis. Let's put it in the bladder. It's a cavity, and maybe we'll see some results. So that's a little side historic note there.
Lovely story.
But, you know, coming to the TAR-200 device, Neil, you know, just full disclosure, I've known the folks that have worked with this for many, many years. It was first used to deliver lidocaine in the bladder for patients that had really interstitial cystitis. And then the thought process of putting in gemcitabine, which is what the TAR-200 device is, and we call it the pretzel, patients call it the pretzel, the company hates us calling it that because it sounds like a food item, which it is. But essentially what it is releasing gemcitabine. So you get this constant release, but it's also a little bit of metronomic dosing, right? And whether it actually has anti-angiogenic effects or not is a matter of discussion for another day. But there have been numerous studies done with TAR-200, which is the gemcitabine device, and they're all called Sunrise studies, and Tom is on many of them as well. So Sunrise 1, essentially, is TAR-200. For BCG-unresponsive, high-risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So patients who've had BCG and then have recurrence with high-grade disease and meet certain specific criteria. And there were several cohorts. Cohort 1 was TAR-200 plus J&J's own IO, sutrolimab. Cohort 2 was TAR-200 monotherapy, and then cohort 3 was sutrolimab monotherapy, and then cohort 4 was TAR-200 and the papillary disease. And long story short, only cohort 2 and cohort 4 moved forward because the benefit of adding IO wasn't enough. And if you look at the data from the cohort 2 and cohort 4, very impressive results. Extremely high complete response rates in BCG unresponsive disease for CIS, which is a regulatory endpoint. Also for papillary disease, which is more of a practical endpoint, not so much a regulatory endpoint, simply because you need a control arm there. Low side effects, patients tolerated really well. So really, I think the approval of this has raised the bar for us in the field in giving us a agent that really we can offer to patients now that everything else now aspires to beat. So the whole Sunrise paradigm is quite remarkable, in my opinion.
So Ashish, let's finish out with another paper that you covered in your talk there. This one, look, we've been talking a lot about ctDNA. This is looking at real-world experience with ctDNA and non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Can you comment, please?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that was one of the papers that we discussed because it is one of those papers that I think the community and urologists and medical oncologists have read and then gone into use in practical terms without paying attention to the details. And by that, what do I mean? So essentially, ctDNA, if it's positive, it usually means that there is something shedding K cancer cells into the circulation, and we're picking it up, of course, on the DNA aspect, on the DNA side of things. It doesn't mean that the patient has incurable disease. It doesn't mean that the patient has metastatic disease. And in this particular paper, they looked at patients with non-muscle invasive disease. They detected ctDNA in two patients, and it led to the diagnosis of more advanced disease than was being suspected. Now, if you had done due diligence, if you'd done a deeper resection, appropriate imaging, would he have picked those patients up or not? We don't know. But essentially, two patients had more involved or invasive disease than was being advertised, so to speak. And that's a good message, right? That's a good message that if you use ctDNA and it's positive, look for something more than non-muscle invasive disease. I think what's happened, and unfortunately, I've had patients referred to me, where the urologist or the medical oncologist has gotten a ctDNA, it's positive. The patient has an unresected T1 tumor in the bladder, and the patient has now been told, you have metastatic disease, go on and get systemic therapy, and then if it doesn't come down, you know, it's lights out, right? I've had this patient referred to me. I've gone in, I've resected the tumor, the ctDNA has gone down to zero, and this patient has saved their bladder and then gone on to get BCG. So I think this study is great proof of concept. It essentially shows that systemic detection of ctDNA, which is what essentially this is, should raise an alert. It should caution us that the patient may have more than non-muscle invasive disease, but the accuracy, the positive predictive value, the negative predictive value, really, it's poor for non-muscle invasive disease. So I'm enthusiastic about it in muscle invasive disease and in selected cases of non-muscle invasive disease, but we can't really overreact to these positive signals. And I almost want to mention this paper as a word of caution. Don't overinterpret the results.
And you mentioned there in your last point there in terms of your thoughts about future clinical trials and how they should be set up in terms of clinical decision algorithms. Can you comment on what kind of trials you'd like to see done, Ashish?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a comment I made incorporating cytology, FISH assays, UTDNA, combining that with imaging, endoscopy, ctDNA, essentially in a way that we can now use these tools that we have today to advise patients on when bladder sparing is appropriate, either after they've had systemic therapy of muscle invasive disease, or even if they've had intravesical or other therapy for what we normally would consider indicators for radical cystectomy, such as really deep T1B disease, histologic subtypes, etc. So I think these trials are being done. They will be read out. And once they're read out, we'll have more information. But till then, I use these. I'm sure Tom uses these. I'm sure many people listening use these assays. But we have to remember that we have to use clinical judgment, temper it with a little bit of salt and not put too much into it when we don't have data to back it up yet.
So Ashish and Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Audience, thank you for tuning in. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ashish. Tom, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Neil.